Roxanne and Allison, you're dressed up.
Okay.
I was telling them we ought to wrap them up and send them to somebody.
Hawaii, yes.
Get all these beautiful Valentines, Granny. Happy Valentine's. That's on the record, too. Call State Affairs to order at 8:47 on February the 14th, 1990. I'll let the record show that present are Representative Hanley, Representative Finkelstein, Representative McLean, another Valentine. Eileen, good morning. All right, I don't know what I ate. Too much coffee, I guess. One of the things that I want to talk to the committee about, just very briefly before we get on with the agenda, and we've got a full one, there are going to be two pieces of legislation read across today as State Affairs Committee legislation. I sent them to you, they were delivered over your packet. Simply take a look at them. What they are direct recommendations from the Commission on the Permanent Fund, which was a bipartisan group. Number one, the payout is a bit complex, if you will, in that it takes a lot of time to really understand what it's all about. But what the payout rule is simply designed to do is stop several practices. Most people don't know that in order to get money into revenue for the dividends, we've got to sell stocks at certain times of the year, whether the value's up, down, or what have you. That we need to take a look at how we inflation-proof the fund. It's not just a simple thing to take and, let's say, put inflation-proofing before dividends. It was some thoughts of that. There may be some downsides in different times. But the payout rule is one that's generally approved by the Permanent Fund Commission and by people who've been relatively close to it. So there will be adequate presentations. But I thought it was appropriate that any legislation that comes out as a direct result of the report, I introduced two other pieces of legislation that I thought should be introduced as an individual, and I didn't include those as State Affairs. But anything that's coming out of here should be committee legislation. So that's what those two are. The second is a disclosure, which simply means that there are, like the Armada Hess litigation money, that people ought to know that that was taken out of it. They ought to know that what the cost of the administrative funds are. So that is a complete disclosure of anything that's taken out of the dividend stream during the process. So they will be both read across today, and we'll probably, not probably, we will be holding hearings next week on them. So if there's any questions, be sure and contact staff on them, okay? All right. Get the order of business. What do we got here? All right. The first piece of legislation we have before us is HB. No. Excuse me, Ann.
SB.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's SB 343. Mm-hmm. Okay. The first piece of legislation is SB 343. An act relating to the retirement incentive program and providing for an effective committee substitute for Senate Bill 343. We have Gary Johnson on teleconference from Fairbanks who wanted to testify. Gary, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Would you go ahead, sir? 343 is before us, and we're now accepting public testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, actually, I'm from Anchorage. Rich, I did live up in Fairbanks at one time. Does everybody on the committee have a statement that I forwarded yesterday afternoon? Titled Proposed Amendment to the Retirement Incentive Program, Chapter 89, SLA 89, Section 7.
Item 8. Yes, we do, Gary.
Very much, Mr.
That's
Chairman.
Item 8 in your...
I'm particularly good at public speaking, so that's why I prepared a statement so committee members could take a glance at that. I'd appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on the proposed amendments to the retirement incentive program. My comments are primarily on the matter of the interpretation of Section 7 and the possible need to amend or clarify the meaning of Section 7. Basically, I've worked for the state as a state employee for about 20 years. 2.5 of those years, however, with a state public organization. Before that organization became a member of the public employees retirement system. The main issue, I think, is whether the credit under Section 7, the same credit for eligibility under the age or service criteria that is specifically spelled out under Section 2G. In the statement there, I have the text of Section 2G, which is right from the retirement incentive program law. Basically, I won't read the whole thing, but it basically says that a person can combine age or service for eligibility for a normal retirement under the program. Section 7, which is also directly under the Retirement Incentive Program statute, also refers to a credit. This credit is for employment with a public organization before the organization became an employer under the system. I've also put in the text of Section 7, which is right in the Retirement Incentive Program. Section 7 refers to a credit, however, it does not clearly spell out what the credit is, as it does in Section 2G. Clearly, however, the reference to credit under Section 7, under a chapter that's specifically entitled Retirement Incentive Program, should be the same credit that is specifically spelled out in the legislation under Section 2G. Age and service credit are ordinarily not confined in the regular retirement system, but the Retirement Incentive Program does provide for the exception to other statutes. Section 7 itself begins by saying, notwithstanding other provisions of law, and the section itself refers to a person who is participating in the retirement program may receive this credit. Also, Senator Jim Duncan also agrees with my interpretation in the context of the RIP legislation. The Division of Retirement Benefits is saying that the credit under Section 7 only applies to service, not to credit for eligibility by age. They are referring to other retirement statutes, however, that are not under the current retirement incentive program. So if you agree with my interpretation and that of Senator Duncan, an amendment to Section 7 should be nothing more than a housekeeping change. There will be absolutely no fiscal impact because any credit received under this section must contribute to the cost savings of the agency. And on the last page is a proposed draft amendment to SLA 89 Section 7. The only change in here is that I've added wording directly from Section 2G, which makes the credit very clear. It's possible, however, that the amendment could be made even shorter by simply covering the definition of retirement statute. I really appreciate this opportunity to comment, and I would be happy to answer any questions that I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. We've got other testimony here, and I think some people will be responding to your individual statement. So just stay online, and if questions arise, we'll be back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Anna, is there anyone else online?
No,
all right, that's on. Okay. I right, back to Juneau. We have Bob Stallnaker, who indicated that he wished to testify. And Bob, if you would care to respond, or if you desire to respond to Mr. Johnson's testimony, feel free to do so, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Stallnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The administration supports the bill in its current status. In response to Mr. Johnson's testimony, I think he's correctly characterized that there's a difference in how we interpret the language compared to how he would like the language interpreted. What he proposes in Section 7 does what he would like it to do, which is to allow him to use service rendered for a political subdivision prior to their inclusion under the system and substitute that for age. As an example, a 45-year-old person could now qualify under the Retirement Incentive Program with this provision. Currently, you have to be at least 47 because the RIP credit, and I would disagree in that the RIP credit being offered under the Retirement Incentive Program is a special kind of credit. It's a credit of years. Those years could be applied towards service, or that credit could be applied towards age requirements. If somebody were 47 years old, they could use the 3 years to meet the 50-year-old requirement for an early retirement. Or if they had 27 years of service, they could use the 3 years to meet the 30-year requirement for service requirement for retirement. Provision 7 was introduced to allow state employees to use public service that they rendered before the specific political subdivision became a member of the system, but to use that service towards, as we interpret it, the service requirement. In other words, if they had 25 years of state service, but they had worked for 4 years with a political subdivision and never got credit for that, they could use that towards meeting the 30-year requirement. That's consistent with all past practice. That's consistent with the system in using service worked towards service requirements and actual age towards age requirements. What this provision would do is allow somebody to take service worked and apply it towards an age requirement. And if you, you know, wanted to stretch the possibilities, it could allow somebody who's 35 years old to retire under the RIP if they had 13 years of service for a political subdivision before its inclusion. And we have political subdivisions entering this year that have, that aren't recognizing past service and that have never belonged to the retirement or public employees retirement system. Some technical problems that we would have with this provision is that we don't know how many people out there would even qualify, because we don't know, you know, we're not dealing with just 47-year-old and people who are older anymore. We're dealing with the whole 60,000 members under the system. And depending on how much service they may have with some other political subdivision before its inclusion. So the first thing we would have to do is determine how many people would be involved. Then we'd have to go back to the employers and readjust all their costs because of these inclusions. This amendment is something totally contrary to the system as it currently exists. And I don't think we would recommend favorable treatment of this amendment.
Thank you. Gary, obviously we were commenting on your testimony. Would you care? I'll give you the opportunity to comment and to have an exchange on this if you desire.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I've been primarily dealing with the interpretation. I think it's absolutely clear that when you have a reference to a credit in a chapter which is referring to the Retirement Incentive Program, that that credit should apply to the one definition.
you care to reply, or?
Mr. Chairman, I think in Mr. Johnson's case, he only has a couple years that could apply. As I said, we don't know how many people are out there with how many different combinations could be faced, and I can appreciate Mr. Johnson's concerns. I think that it is practice, and perhaps you know, somebody from the AG's office or from legislative legal could give some little clearer testimony on this, but I believe intent and past practice is important when laws are passed. I don't think you can look at the language of the law specifically and say something else was meant when it's not clearly spelled out that it was meant to be different. I think because political subdivision service deals with service and the retirement programs are consistent in their application of service, I think that's the driving force in this. And that's certainly the way we've interpreted it. And it's also, I might add, and I've been involved in all the testimony for both retirement incentive bills. And never has any testimony, you know, implied anything different.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question on essentially the existing program. Our existing retirement program, completely apart from the incentive program, related to this amendment, what credit do you get, if any, for service for a body that's now in the PERS system but wasn't previously? What credit do you get under the existing system?
Through the chair, Representative Finkelstein. Hi. Under the public employees retirement system, the employer, upon entrance, can decide how much past service to grant. And they can decide for the current employees how much of the past service for that employer they want to grant. Because the bottom line is the employer has to pay for it. Past service costs go to the employer. So it's the purpose of the systems are to attract and retain good employees for the public employers of the state. And it's since they're paying for it, they get the choice of how much to bring in.
Thank you. So let's say a local government body decides to allow credit and a person has 5 years coming in for previous work, and that's applied. In those cases, is that only applied to the yearly requirement, the total year's requirement to meet the retirement, or are there cases where that's applied to reduce the age requirement to get into retirement?
Through the chair, in no case has credit ever been applied to reduce age requirements. Credit is credit. There are two thresholds that must be met under the system. One is, to be vested under the system, you have to have a certain amount of service, and service is consistently applied. The other threshold is, to be eligible to retire, you have to meet one of two requirements. One is either an age requirement, or the other is a service requirement. They're not intermixed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hanley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm a little bit confused. I'm looking at political subdivision, and during the interim, I had a constituent call me who was talking about service he had with the Kenai, in Kenai, the city or whatever that is. They were not under PERS at that time, and they are under PERS now, and he was inquiring, could somehow he pay into the Kenai retirement system for the 10 years, and I did some research on that, and I didn't come up. In fact, I had talked with Senator Duncan, and we discussed it. But I think, as you said, then Kenai would then be responsible. I think his debate, I guess, would have to be with the city of Kenai. Is that correct? They would then have to, if they agreed to that, they would have to then pay a portion of his retirement. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hanley, that's basically correct. If the employee is saying they worked 10 years for Kenai before Kenai came in, mm-hmm. and Kenai did not recognize any past service, in other words, it only provided the benefits from that point forward, then it would be up to Kenai to have to bring that service in, absent special legislation. Legislation passed by the legislature that granted people past service for any public employment they may have had certainly would help this person, and that would be a cost that would then be forced onto all the employers. Okay, but the way it stands right now, the employers are in essence in control of their own destiny as far as costs. So in that case, yes, they'd have to work that out with Keenan.
Are there any other questions? Roxanne or Allison, would you care to comment? I noticed you're not down here to testify this morning on this.
Would you want an overview of the deal, or just like everybody already understand it?
That would be appropriate. It's my intention for the other members to move this legislation out of committee this morning, unless there is any objections. It's been worked on quite a bit. I have had the opportunity to work with Representative Duncan. There was one amendment in the packet that Representative Boyer had suggested, but we are going to defer that. He has not had the opportunity to go over it in depth with Senator Duncan, and there's a concern that it might increase the fiscal note. And since the next committee of referral is finance, I think it would be it'll be adequately discussed there. Roxanne?
Yeah. Representative Foster and members of the committee. The retirement incentive program was implemented in June of 89, and the program continues through November of this year. Employers choosing to participate in the retirement incentive are required to show a personal services savings. Chapter 89, which is in your packets, also explicitly states in Section 2B that the organizational units of the plan must be selected so that implementation of the plan results in maximum savings to the employer and personal services costs within 3 years after the commencement of the plan. In the 86-87 program, the savings was calculated over a five-year period. The three-year calculation mandated in the current program has rendered many long-term state employees ineligible, because OMB is strictly interpreting each individual position as an organizational unit. Thus, if a savings is not shown on an individual's position over the 3 years, that person is not considered eligible for the program. School districts and the university have not taken the same approach to organizational units and thus have not experienced similar problems. Preliminary information which we received from Retirement and Benefits indicates that a total of 8,652 employees are potentially eligible for the retirement incentive. There are 2,987 state employees. Only 61.5% of them have been designated to participate. Current OMB statistics show that 1,660 state employees have been designated to participate. If all of those employees retire, they estimate that almost $16.7 million will be saved in personal services costs over the next 3 years. Comparison of the current program with the 86-87 program indicates that in the prior program, 83% of eligible state employees were designated to participate versus 61.5% in the current program. We believe that clearly shows that many more employees are not qualifying for the program under the three-year savings criteria. Because incentives for long-term employees are more costly to the employer than those for short-term employees, it is very likely that when we receive the detailed information which we have requested from OMB, it will show that long-term employees make up the bulk of those who have not qualified for the program. Let's see. To briefly explain the reason why many long-term employees have not been designated to participate, a person with 30 years of service earns a retirement benefit of almost 65% of their ending salary. A person with only 10 years service earns only 20% of their ending salary. Since the cost of participation in the incentive is based on an actuarial calculation of the cost to the retirement system of the three-year incentive plus the current value of any increased lifetime benefit, it costs more for long-term employees to participate. If an individual is relatively young and has many years of service, the problem is compounded. Exhibits A and B in your folder show the difference the five-year calculation makes on a typical employee's savings calculation. Exhibit C is an example of a three-year calculation of an Anchorage employee who was found ineligible. I think they didn't show a savings of $4.71, so that person is not eligible. Senate Bill 373, as currently written, is very limited in scope. It basically makes changes which only affect state government It does not change the window periods of the program, and it will not change or add an additional incentive over what was offered in Chapter 8989. The current window, the window periods remain June 30th of 89 through December 31st of 89 for teachers and university employees to apply. They must retire by August 1st of 1990. The state period, state and municipal employees must apply between September 30th of 89 and March 31st of 1990 and retire before November 1st of 1990. For your information, the Senate State Affairs Committee added language on page 3, line 1, which will allow Division of Elections employees until February 1, 1991 to retire. This will allow the division to retain RIP eligible employees on board through the 1990 general election and its certification. To summarize the proposed amendments to the retirement incentive program, they are: one, increase the period within which savings must be shown from 3 to 5 years; two, allow employees to pay a part of the employer's share of the retirement incentive cost in order to show a savings, or allow the employer or the employee to elect a reduced benefit in order to reduce the employer's cost; the closure of the application period for state employees on March 31st makes it of paramount importance that Senate Bill 343 progress through the legislative process as swiftly as possible so that many deserving long-term state employees can participate. In this way, the state can realize the maximum savings possible through the use of the retirement incentive program.
Thank you, Roxanne. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Hanman? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a generic question that is really affects or concerns retirement in general. It's been brought to my attention that retirement benefits are calculated not strictly on base pay, but on base pay plus overtime. Is that true for all state employees or some departments when in calculating the average of the high 3 years? I guess that's the way it's done. The percentage of the high 3 years. Is the high 3 years based on base salary, or is it based on base salary plus overtime plus something else?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanley, I think retirement and benefits would probably be much better equipped to answer that question than I or Allison.
Bob, do you want to respond?
Sure.
Are there any other questions of Roxanne?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanley, the benefits are calculated on compensation as it's defined under statute. Compensation includes pay for all hours worked. It does not include things like tool allowances or other employer-sponsored benefits that might be given. So in answer to your basic question, overtime is included in compensation. The employee and the employer pay contributions on that overtime also while it's being earned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. Mr. Stallmaker, on Section 7, I was listening to Mr. Johnson from Fairbanks and his proposed amendment. I just wondered what it would do to the vested member of the political subdivision if we were to make that amendment. How would it affect the vested member?
Through the chair, Representative McLean, this Section 7 does not affect employees of political subdivisions.
Mm-hmm.
It only affects state employees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only to recognize service that a state employee may have worked for a political subdivision prior to its inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? The chair will entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Any objections? Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 343 moves out of committee with individual recommendations. Thanks for those of you who took the time to testify. Next legislation before us is HB 451. An act relating to conduct of legislators, legislative employees, former legislative and legislative employees, and to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. I have no one. I have no one that has signed up to testify. Who's here on this? I understand that Representative Davis wished to testify.
Is Barbara there? Hi, this is Ann. 451 is on.
Did you call Mike Davis's office?
I called Galdon.
They're expecting a call for you.
Talk about a couple of amendments they wanted to offer. Would this be a good time?
Oh. Representative, yeah. Let's let Representative Davis come forward. You've indicated you wanted to testify on 451. It's before us.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we on telecom?
No.
No.
We are. No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if have you started proceedings on this legislation yet?
You're the proceedings.
Okay. Thanks. Let me just make some opening comments on the legislation, if I could, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. When I began my job as chairman of the House Select Committee on Ethics a year ago, I asked. People in my office and also legal affairs to take a look at the ethics law, take a look at what areas perhaps need to be changed or strengthened. And so we sort of kept an ongoing file over the past year. And then over the interim, we came up with a sort of a laundry list of issues that to bring to the committee to take action on, and so as a result of that list of different subject areas that we felt that should be changed in the ethics law, the committee met as a whole just before session began and kind of started narrowing that field down, I suppose, and as a result of that. We introduced a piece of legislation in the House and the Senate, and this was agreed to by the full Ethics Committee. In other words, the three public members, the members of the Senate and the House. Now, all the provisions that made it into the final bill were not unanimous by any means. In fact, some of them were adopted with only five votes, five out of the nine, and others had much more support. And I guess the other thing is that there is probably some others that may be included, you know, given recent events. But let me go over the basic bill and some of the components of that rather than do a sexual analysis. The biggest change, I think, to the bill is the complaint procedure, and that's the last five pages of the bill. The complaint procedure opens up the process. You know, as it is currently, most of the process is behind closed doors, and that's certainly been a subject of contention. As of late, but I've always felt that there should be more public process or openness to the process, and yet there was a concern by members of the committee that we didn't want people to be tried in the press, so to speak. So what we've tried to do is fashion something that opens the process, and by this, the procedure, what we've done is to say, and just so I have it correctly here, is that the bill currently would have the proceedings that will be confidential until probable cause is determined by the committee, and then they are open after that point. There are some people that feel that should be, that's not, that having it closed to that point is far too long, and the committee may wish to change that. But the other thing that that some people have felt that, and I have an amendment drafted to this extent, but that the proceedings, once you make a determination that you're going to dismiss a case because there's no probable cause, then the dismissal order should be open to the public, and I have an amendment that will do that. Other major provisions of this legislation have to do with the statute of limitations. Currently, the statute of limitations are only 2 years, and this bill would establish a 5-year statute of limitations, which would match the state limitations for all criminal proceedings, or most criminal proceedings. And another thing that we adopted in this legislation is the 1-year ban on lobbying by ex-legislators, which was just adopted by the United States Congress, House of Representatives. Another issue, Mr. Chairman, is the issue on representation. And that was another issue that was debated extensively in the committee, and there's been a lot of discussion by other members of the legislature on this one. But the provision that we adopted would prohibit all individuals covered by the ethics law, which is legislators and staff range 18 above, from representing clients for pay before state agencies, boards, and commissions. What can happen in current law is you can be paid to lobby a commissioner of the same department that you may be a member of the finance committee and have that person's budget before you as a member of finance. So we felt that by having some kind of a ban on representation would give some public confidence in the separation between,
excuse me, go ahead, Mike.
Between your job as a legislator and representing private clients. There was concern by attorneys in this provision, and it doesn't limit them from the conducting business in court, although it would limit, the way it's currently written, it would limit their participation in other quasi-judicial boards. And I have in your packets the 4 alternatives that we looked at, and I know Representative Donnelly is interested in this issue, and there may be interest in not having the ban on representation quite as restrictive as what we adopted. The other provision, major provision on this, is the gift provision. In our legislation, we raised the gift provision from $50 to $100, we also had an advisory opinion, 89-3, which basically says if you get a gift of substantial value from friends or from or an engagement ring, wedding ring, or you know, something that has nothing to do with your legislative work, you could accept that gift. One other area of the legislation, Mr. Chairman, is the area of honorarium. We adopted something that the United States House adopted, which is the ban on honorarium for its members. And the last major provision of this legislation is the area of fundraisers. And what we found is that, let's say you're a senator down here and you decide in your off year to run for lieutenant governor or for governor, that there's no prohibition in law for you to not have fundraisers in the Capitol. If you're a senator, you're prohibited, but if you decide in your off year to run for another seat or whatever, there's no ban against that. Or if you decide to run for governor. The other thing that committee members decided, and I frankly didn't support this, but to extend the ban to current members of the Juneau delegation. Currently, they are not banned from fundraising in their capital, just like we are not banned from fundraising in our own home districts. And they expanded that ban to not only for all legislators here in Juneau, including the ones that are currently here. Now, I do have a number of amendments, Mr. Chairman. I have a sectional analysis, which I could, if you wish, or Mr. Gagin is here, who is counsel to the full Ethics Committee. It's however you wish, Mr. Chairman. I've tried to just kind of give you a brief overview of the legislation. And I think, frankly, most of the items that was discussed or that we looked at was adopted by the committee. And as I said, the one issue which you may wish to have even more open than we did is the whole complaint procedure. But all the issues that we looked at were frankly adopted by the committee, but you may wish to strengthen some of the provisions of the law, but I appreciate the opportunity to come before you and bring this issue.
Thank you, Representative Davis. For those of you who are online waiting to testify on House Bill 338, we'll take that up at about 20 minutes of. Duncan, I'm going to try and get your legislation. It looks like it might be a little tough today. Do you mind if I carry that over to tomorrow's calendar? Because these people have been waiting out there, and I'm sure if there's an opportunity to get to it, I sure will.
Well,
let me tell you what I'd like to do on this with the various people that are here. This is a piece of legislation that badly needs a lot of work on it. I think the reasons are very obvious. And I intend to see that it gets a thorough working over in this committee. One of the things that concerns me is what has happened. I don't think that legislators should be sitting in the position of judging the quality. And I tell you ahead of time, I'm going to do something to see if we can change that. It places us in a bad position. I mean, you can see what's happening on the other side, and I'm not talking about it up or down or what have you. Representative Finkelstein would have Representative Hanley, Representative Donley, and myself, and any of the other members that had served in helping putting this together. Obviously, Peter, this is going over to Judiciary, and you could now help us play a role. But I'm not going to move this thing on until we've got a good piece of legislation. I'm just not going to react. I'm going to try and respond to the problem. How does that fit your agenda, Representative Davis?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't really have an agenda on this, but let me just say that this is not a knee-jerk piece of legislation.
No, I know that. I know it is.
By that, I mean we've been looking at this for a long time, and some of the issues that the Senate has asked to look at is issues that we have been working on for a long time, and so we've had counsel working on this issue for a long time. How you handle your this issue, I think, is certainly your decision, and I appreciate the seriousness that you're giving to this piece of legislation, because I think the public demands it. Let me just say a couple things, Mr. Chairman, as long as I do have the floor. In your packets, we do have a number of amendments on foreign gifts, cumulative gifts, and on the Juneau fundraising and dismissal orders by the public. I frankly think that the foreign gifts needs to be strengthened. I didn't win that in my committee. And also, just for the information of the members, we do have a kind of a brief synopsis of the major points of the legislation within the packet. the subcommittee may wish to look at this. This is something that Mr. Gagin drafted up, which is kind of a flow chart showing how the complaint process could work. And like I said, you may wish to change this, because one of the things that we looked at was part of the problem, and you know, part of the reason why we changed the statute of limitations was, one, because a 2-year statute of limitations is part of the reason why there was a limit to what the Senate could do in their proceedings about a certain complaint, so we decided to expand it. Well, the other thing we found out, Mr. Chairman, was that even with this, the adoption, which making this more public, a lot of the complaints that we've had before the Ethics Committee would still remain confidential and not open to the public. So you may wish to look at this flow chart and open it up even more, given the, as I said earlier, given the, some of the new considerations on this piece of legislation or this issue.
Well, my thoughts on it, I certainly know it's not knee-jerk, and I didn't intend to do to indicate that it was. There's a lot of hard work gone on it. But most of the legislation I can take a close look at, as the rest of the people, and we tend to expedite this here. This one here is a type that we're going to have a subcommittee, and there's going to be work sessions on the thing. And if I don't get the people to attend, then they're off the subcommittee. And I intend to have some evening work sessions on it. I mean, I think it's important enough, the work that you've done, to maybe just add to it. And before I would move to do anything, any amendments, I want to understand the piece of legislation. And so I intend to read it over thoroughly, talk to the various people that have been involved. In fact, I'm going to put myself on this subcommittee so you can be sure that we'll be working on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gagin has been working on this issue, and I'm sure he'd be glad to offer his assistance. He attended a conference, which I wish I frankly would have had the opportunity to, which is the CODIL conference, which is kind of the annual conference of people that are working on this issue, and we had a conversation just a little while ago, but there is certainly other approaches to this where you have some kind of an ethics commission, and there's been some talk about that. And I know he has some knowledge of that, of how other states have approached this, but not all states have legislators and members of the public sitting together. Some of them don't have any members of the public sitting in judgment. And up till now, anyway, it's certainly not been this legislature's or prior legislature's wish to have be judged by someone other than their peers. So at least not have a majority of members being sitting in judgment for us. But there's certainly more ways than one to approach this issue. And again, thank you for your cooperation. Appreciate it.
Peter, I know that you would come down specifically to testify on it. What I'd like to do, I've still got some people who have been waiting all morning on other legislation, but this is priority legislation. Would you care to comment?
Be very brief.
All right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Peter Gall, representative of House District 2. I just wish to drop in to visit for a moment to indicate my support for action on the ethics questions that are in the bill, to encourage the work that you just described, to indicate that my staff and myself are at your service in that regard. I think it would be very useful to take the opportunity to listen to Mr. Davis, Mr. Porchot, other members of the committee who I think I had an opportunity to sit in on a few of the meetings. I was very impressed by the level of seriousness about the issue. I also had an opportunity to listen to comments from the other body suggesting, even on the press this morning, that or in the news this morning, that they are moving towards acceptance of some changes and improvements in the code. And I would respectfully encourage the committee to work with your Senate counterparts as well in that regard. I guess speaking for myself, I think it's very important that we move forward on this expeditiously. At the same time, I agree with the chair that nothing would be worse than putting out something that is not adequate to the task. So I'd also appreciate your taking a look at your convenience at the new language, which the Ethics Committee put out for the bill which you passed of mine through this committee regarding representation. I think their language is superior, and really commend their efforts on it. They put in a good deal of work. So I just wanted to let you know about that since it had passed through the committee to indicate we're at your service, to urge prompt resolution of the questions, and to encourage communication with the members of the Ethics Committee as you do your deliberations. Last comment was I did hear on the news, on the press this morning, that there was some feeling that, that the bill gave certain things to us in terms of making life easier and took other things away in terms of making things more stringent. I would hope that that criticism could be dealt with so that people can see that we're trying to clean up our act. And I guess finally, too, I would say that one of the things that's come to my attention is that there is a difficult area, and that is, like in one case that had to do with travel, expenditure of travel funds, the freedom with which certain funds are allocated within the legislature may really be the problem. In other words, if you give a chairman basically unlimited travel and they use it that way, it's very hard for a judge or an ethics committee or anybody to say it was wrong. But if there are standards for how money is used and dispensed, and those are clear, a lot of the aftermath might be eliminated. I respectfully call the attention of the committee to that as a philosophic approach to dealing with certain problems that maybe haven't been dealt with adequately, because once you establish the facts, you still don't know whether or not you've really violated a standard, because you don't have a standard to violate. So looking at standards might be as useful as looking at quasi-judicial remedies. So thank you again.
Is there anybody else that wishes to comment? While you're still here, Peter, David, what I'd like to have you do is contact the other people, and we'll set up a work schedule on this, an evening work schedule, where we can bring people and sit down here and get cracking on this thing right away. In other words, I think it's important for all of us to devote enough time to it. So I'm counting on you being the point person. You can coordinate with my staff as far as my schedule and each one of the other people. Now, Eileen, would you like to sit in on this, too? I mean, the more brains we've got on this, the better. I know you've got a pretty heavy committee workload.
In the evenings.
Yeah, right. And you can... We're going to sit down and work. We're not going to try and make it political football or what have you. We're going to try and see if we can get this thing on track, because the basic goal would be to establish public confidence again in the system.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gagin, I'm sure, will be quite willing to help, but he may give you some background in some of the different, maybe a sectional analysis would be helpful by him at, when you have your initial meeting, and he can give you a sort of a synopsis of how the committee dealt with each one of those sections.
I think that would be the way that I attempt. We go to school on this subject. I mean, he's done an awful lot of work, and I don't intend to reinvent the wheel. But I want everybody comfortable so they really understand where we are now. I mean, maybe it's to the point that just a bit of fine-tuning could move it on. So just as soon as we can coordinate that, it's fine with me. And thank you for all the hard work that you've done on it. It's been a lot of work put into it, so we want to give it the effort that it deserves.
I'll try to make the first year initial meeting.
All right. Well, Dave's going to be the point person on it. Thank you very much. I had schedule HB 452, and we got about 15 minutes before session. And I thank you very much for those of you who've been waiting on HB 338, which is a deregulation of cable television. I think we have Marty Robinson on line in Anchorage, and also that we have people online from Ketchikan, which is to testify. Ketchikan 2. Marty, why don't you go ahead from Anchorage? We're going to take this up. I doubt very much if we're going to be able to get anything done today on it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you and your representatives for allowing Prime Cable to give its view regarding. Missouri House Bill 338. To bring you up to stuff on this, since 1986, we have, from every year, last 5 years, talked about some form of re-regulation of cable television. In 86, it was House Bill 665. 87 and 88 was 97. And now we're at House Bill 338. And frankly, from our viewpoint, we simply don't understand the preoccupation with the cable industry in Alaska by Representative Robin Taylor. Besides that, we have monopoly status, and that our rates are too high, but yet we don't believe that he fully understands our business. We as cable operators are very clear about our business. We feel like we do a good job in the communities that we serve. We're not perfect, but yet we continue to strive to better ourselves. But I guess the point is if this is so important today in Alaska's economy, I'd like to know what the public outrage is. Now, currently, all the operators serve about between 85,000 and 90,000 customers. Those are people that pay the bill. If you look at the households, there's more than a quarter of a million people in the entire state of Alaska that watch cable television. That's over half the population of the state. Where is this tremendous public outcry? We don't see it. I don't see it here in Anchorage. I can't speak for the other systems, and I guess there's some representation down there in Juneau regarding some of the other systems, but we just don't see it. Cable television is highly visible. You read about it in the newspaper, you see it on television. Senator Metzenbaum, Senator Danforth, all believe it. There should be some form of re-regulation. Senator Stevens, from our own state, believes cable companies should be left alone. Too much governmental control would probably stagnate the growth in the future of the cable industry, and he supports that issue. Over the years, Representative Taylor tried to deregulate it, to decertify it, and some we still understand the reason. The system of certification through the AFUC works. It qualifies good companies. The criteria for accepting the application of a cable company allows them to scrutinize the fitness, the willingness, and the ability to serve the respective areas in which they would like to serve. If the system currently works today, then the question has to be asked, why are we tampering with it? Congress mandates that there be some form of regulatory control, not in regards to rate or service or picture quality, but there has to be a governing body. It just can't go willy-dilly and do whatever it wants to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I ask a question? Yes, Representative Finkelstein. This is Representative Finkelstein. What's your most common complaint that you do get in the proceedings for transfer?
Well, the most common one that we got in this particular area was the fact that we had not built, under our previous owner, we had not built certain areas. There are currently about 12,000 homes that did not have the ability to have cable television. And what we stated in the transfer process that we would build down to a certain amount of density in our area. For instance, last year we built 1,600 passings to homes. This year here we're budgeted to build another 4,300, those being Hillside, Eagle River, and Peters Creek. And that was the most blatant complaint that we had.
And of those, what's the usual reason that they can't be hooked up? The ones you're describing that they can't be.
Yeah, over the years, cable has not been built in their area, so they don't have the ability to have it. We're committed to giving them the ability to have it.
Is there, what would be the second most common complaint next to that one?
Well, you know, there's no common complaint. We get various complaints. You know, people talk about our rate. They say, you know, is 86 cents a day too much for basic cable? I don't think so. My biggest cost is programming. This year here, our programming cost is $5.1 million. We don't control that. But we're not tied to the program. We buy the program. So when I go out and explain that, yes, from 1989 to 1990, I have $800,000 increase in programming to prime cable. And just programming alone, those costs are sure going to go up. But we didn't hold the fact that we were going to raise rates. In our transfer proceedings, we stated for the next 4 years, we will raise our rates by 7% to keep up with inflation and to keep up with just the expenses of the operation. We didn't hold it. Were there any complaints about that? There were none. And we stated that on public record. We have complaints about programs. Some people don't like MTV. Some people don't like Black Entertainment Network. Some people don't like the access channels. The problem is when you're in cable television, it's not like being a broadcaster. You know, you've got so many channels, you're trying to get a wide array of people. You can't satisfy everyone. But the majority of the people that have our product enjoy it.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Taylor, we have two people on in Ketchikan that I understand which wish to testify, and we've got about 4 minutes before the House is called to order.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was up at the Rules Committee. I'm supposed to be sitting on it also at the same time right now on Senate Bill 15, the right to strike bill for teachers. We had to come down, so I didn't want to keep you delayed. Courtesy to yourself and this committee, I've appeared here. I have provided a handout that is somewhat self-explanatory. On the front of it is the bill that I have filed, and some FCC information, what's going on in Congress, why Congress is revisiting the entire question. In addition to that, you'll find an article by Lawrence Lorentz. In addition to that, you'll find in the handout the monthly accounts receivable balance report for the Juneau station to give you an idea of what the net profit alone is off of this business. And I'm a Republican. I have absolutely no problem with people making a profit. I think the profit system works very well in America, as long as government keeps its hands out of the system. The problem is our government, in particular our state government, has its hands fully within the system. In fact, has a stranglehold around anyone else who wishes to compete. There is no opportunity to compete in this area in this state. And as a consequence, because there is no competition, we pay whatever the market will bear. And the tragedy of that is that we also lose some very significant First Amendment rights, in my opinion, that should be preserved and were preserved through the FCC on the radio airways and on the major channel broadcast airways. Now, without those rights to listen to and hear free speech in America, I foresee the day, and it's practically here in Alaska, where if I want to listen to the president's speech, I have to put a dime or a 50-cent piece or whatever into the machine for that many minutes just so I can pay the cable operator and hope that he covers it. I don't have a choice between cable operators to take the one that may provide more speeches by the president as opposed to the guy who provides none. I don't have that choice. That choice has been summarily taken away from me by the legislature of the state of Alaska. And the Alaska Public Utilities Commission itself has been repeatedly for the last, I believe, 4 or 5 years now, strongly recommending to the legislature that they totally deregulate this industry and walk away from it. A fiscal note prepared to go with this bill shows an $18,000 savings per year to this state, to say nothing of what it will save to the communities who no longer have to find themselves stuck with the quote, permitted person for that area. Some of these people are doing an excellent job. I have no quarrel with their industry as far as the quality of the work they're actually doing. Some of them are doing fine. Others are doing very poor. But none of them are subjected to any form of competition. And because they are not subjected to any form of competition, the public pays and pays through the nose. And when you look at that accounting sheet, it's shocking. We have watched these cable companies just in the last 6 years be repeatedly bought and sold every time for a greater price. And you know, not one of those cables hanging out on that telephone pole ever changed, Mr. Chairman. They just bought and sold the same old hardware over and over and over again, and the price went up astronomically. And what are the rate increases for? The rate increases are to pay off the capital of the last guy who bought the system. It doesn't have a thing to do with the quality, number of channels, or anything else. It's like Mr. Finkelstein and I sitting here selling back and forth the same house. And I bought it for $1,000, and now I'm going to sell it to him for $10,000. And then he's going to turn around and sell it back to me for $50,000. And each time the rent on the house goes up. Why? Because you got to pay off the big debt. And then we sell it again and again and again, and pretty soon you got a $1 million house there. You look at the increase in value, capital valuation, paper capital valuation that's occurred in these systems, it's astronomical. They didn't go out and run all new cables all over the country. So as a consequence, I believe this is good and healthy legislation. If the truth were known by those people who object out there, what they are really saying to this committee is, don't take away this sacred monopoly that we got because we paid a lot of money to buy this monopoly permit from somebody else. And gee, if you guys take it away, we might have to compete on a level playing field instead of being able to gouge Anchorage or gouge Juneau for whatever amount we felt like standing out for a bill. And thank you very much, legislators, for not doing anything to shake up our monopoly. We really appreciate it, you know. That's what they're really saying between the lines, Mr. Chairman. And as you well know, I've been sitting in this committee on this bill now. I believe this is the fourth year at least. I'd like to see it move out of this committee, get onto the floor, let's have a vote on it and find out what the people want to have to say about it, not just the people that are making all the money. I've got Mr. Larry Bissell here, and I'm afraid we're not going to have a chance to hear him.
Well, we're not, and this is, I'll tell you, it's not my habit to move a piece of legislation out where there's strong debate. I am by nature a facilitator, and the more the people scream at each other, the more I make them sit down and work something out. So what I would like to do, and David, I'm going to involve you again in this. I want a subcommittee of yourself, Representative Hanley, and I'll put myself on this, and you, Robin, and a member of the industry to sit down and let's reduce the noise level on this and see if we can come up with something on it. It's a highly complex issue, and just simply to take it out to the floor, it's like the competition, no competition, the GCI Alaskan fight. You know, I think you do a disservice sometimes to the public and to the other just to hang things around short slogans. But I do think that there can be some agreement reached on this legislation. And in the past, I've just heard it. I tried to do the best I could as we have. We've got 3 pieces of legislation behind this and just a ton of stuff stuck in this committee, and we're trying to move it on. But I want to give it, since you have devoted so much time to it, I'm going to put this subcommittee together. And David, I just gave you a tough subcommittee to handle. And in this one here, Alice, I'd like you to be the point person on this, if you would. And I think that the very first thing that we need to do is to get Robin sitting down with industry and seeing if there is some bridge that can be built in there. Obviously, later on, we would have to involve APUC. So with that, I'm going to apologize for not to those of you who are online, especially in you, those of you who in Ketchikan have been so very patient at waiting, but there will be adequate time to be heard on this particular legislation. That's indeed why I appointed the subcommittee. I don't think we could do it justice until we've really taken a look at it. There, Representative Taylor, is that satisfactory with you, sir?
Well, it certainly is, and I appreciate your accommodation on it. This thing's a lot like a limited entry permit, Mr. Chairman. And what I'm really talking about is why should somebody be paying $500,000 for a little piece of plastic so they can go fishing? And that's what we're really talking about here, too. And so I don't know whether there's a way to compromise on that. I've certainly looked for one. I don't think there is. I think what's really going to happen here is that while we discuss it and contemplate it, Congress is actually going to do something, I believe, sooner or later.
Thank you. We will carry the rest of the legislation over to tomorrow. I'm going to have to put it at the bottom of the calendar. In other words, the legislation specifically... single member election district and office of the ombudsman, and we'll try and get you out. We only had one item on the agenda tomorrow because we have a gentleman that hopefully has come in from Florida to testify, but he's already been up to Fairbanks where he overheaded, and he's probably overheaded heading south to Seattle. So he's getting a tour of the West Coast. He hasn't, is that correct?
Yes.
He hasn't gotten in yet. I thank you very much for your cooperation. For those of you who are listening online, and Marty, what I want to do is reduce the noise level on this. And your first question that you asked is, what is Representative Taylor's problem on the thing? I think that you will have an opportunity to discuss it one-on-one, and I think that is the best place to take this, at least until we can begin to see if there is some legislation that can be moved on that's satisfactory to everyone.
Representative, may I?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have the opportunity to be able to do that.
All right.
May I volunteer to speak for the consumer's viewpoint in this special committee, if the representatives of the industry are going to be there?
Certainly you can.
Okay, I'd like to put my name on the list.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Why don't you give me your name?
Let me get that out. So that we can sit down.
Just push down that mic there and give your name and address for the record so Ann will have it.
My name is Larry Bazell.
Yeah.
I live at 4523 North Riverside Drive in Juneau. And you might say I'm a consumer advocate. I have no monetary interest in winning this battle. I think the consumers need to win this battle. Thank you.
We are glad to have you.
Who else?
With that, we will adjourn the...
Is it BI?
BU.
BU.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.